Hey, everybody, let's give thanks to our sponsor, MailChimp, for sponsoring today's episode of How Did This Get Made? MailChimp is an email marketing service provider that more than 4 million people and businesses use around the world to send out customized email newsletters. Head to MailChimp.com to learn more and sign up for free with no credit card required. Thanks, MailChimp, and thank you for listening. All right, let's kick this show off. Imagine a less charming and more preachy Willy Wonka. We saw toys, so you know what that means.
Now it's time for How Did This Get Made? We're gonna have a good time, celebrate some failure, not just be a hater. Did you know you wonder how did this get made? Let's wallow in the mediocrity of subpar art. Perhaps we'll find the answer to the question, how did this get made?
Hello, people of Earth, and welcome to How Did This Get Made? I am Paul Scheer, joined, as always, by Jason Manzoukas. How are you, Jason?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
Very good. And June Diane. Oh, she is not here. Sorry.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
unfortunately, June cannot be here today. It's very sad, but there's no conspiracy. All right. We have a very...
Or is there?
Guys, get to the forums.
Maybe the June with her back turned photo in last week's picture.
June is dead.
is just part of this conspiracy.
Oh, man. Okay, I was going to talk about this. Well, forget it. Okay. Not worth it. We are joined by a very special guest. You requested this movie, as a matter of fact. Please welcome Drew McQueenie. You know him from his website, HitFix. I'm a huge fan of him, and I've gotten the chance to bump into him many times over the year. You are a true film fan, an amazing film writer, and we're excited to have you.
Thank you, man. Very good to be here.
But fuck you for making me watch this movie.
Yes, I do.
Fuck you.
Right up front, I say I'm sorry.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Drew sent me a list of movies that we could talk about, and each one of them were great. And I'm sure we'll steal some of them for the show. This one definitely jumped out at me because it was 1992 when this came out. As a kid, I loved comedy. I loved Robin Williams. And I was like, this is like, you know, and this is like the era of time when Robin Williams was blonde. I feel like that was a couple movies, or at least, I don't know, in my mind. And I was excited to see this movie. And I remember being so confused leaving it.
Oh, yeah.
And I just didn't know what to expect. And this movie... it's still confusing. This is an insane movie. Just to give you some background on it, Barry Levinson wrote and directed this movie, or co-wrote and directed this movie. It took him 10 years to write this movie.
What? That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I feel like this movie, if you had equally had said, oh, Barry Levinson had 104 fever for 2 days and he wrote this movie, I'd be like, yep, I believe it.
This is the crazy part. This script for like 15 years was on every list of the best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood.
Really?
Wow.
Everybody loved this thing. There were people who wrote about it constantly. And it was going to be his first film before Diner.
Oh, really?
Really?
That's how long he was working.
Literally, they ran out of the money. And he went and made Diner instead. And thank God, because his career, if this had been the first thing...
That would have been done.
There would have been no Barry Levinson.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's crazy because this movie... I mean, you want to talk about plot or... I mean, like, there's no... I wrote at one point, I was like, well, they don't care about pace because, like, the first seven scenes are equally long and just like, whoa.
It starts with a ballad.
Oh.
It starts with a musical number that's a ballad.
Ugh.
Just like hit him hard.
And a Christmas ballad.
Yeah.
So it's really sugary.
It's like Nutcracker light at the top.
I was like, are they trying to make this like a Christmas movie? Nope.
No, it's always Christmas. I mean, I just didn't quite. I mean, I don't even. I guess at the root of this movie. I mean, I'll just set up the basic premise. There's a very famous toy factory.
I want to listen to how you do this.
A very famous toy factory called Zevo, and is run by a wonderful man, a very loving man who celebrates innocence. He has two children, Robin Williams and Joan Cusack. They also are very equally loving and open and love toys. And the guy who runs the factory, he has a brother who is a British general. Now, no one else is British.
He's an American general who has a British accent.
And is resentful of his British accent.
I was like, could you really, did you have to hire Michael Gambon? Was that it?
Well,
like,
that was my question.
To hire Michael Gambon? I don't know why.
My question is, was it like a chicken before? Like, was it like, was it in the script as a British actor? And then they
And then I wonder about the LL Cool J casting.
Yes.
Because there's a whole other level of, I'm sorry, what?
Yes.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So the American... America, yeah. So the American who has a British accent also has a black son, who is LL Cool J.
Whose mother was evidently a Vietnamese spy at one point.
Who looked enough like Jane Fonda.
No, she looked like Jane. She looked like she was a Vietnamese spy?
Well, she went into...
For our side.
Yes,
yeah, right.
Oh, my God. So, again, you see the movie getting off track, but basically, it's two brothers. One's a peaceful, loving toy maker. The other is a hardcore general, and the peaceful toy maker dies. The general takes over and starts making war toys. And that is basically the end and all of the end of the movie, which is, that's the premise. Toy people versus people for making war toys.
I think, like, in the beginning when you said, like, that, I think the thing to keep in mind on top of that is that the entire movie takes place in a kind of Wonka-esque universe where everything is a toy. The houses are pop-up books.
Yeah.
Everything is fantastical.
And I'm going to mispronounce his name, but it's Magritte, which is, I guess, so it's very heavily influenced by Magritte's work. And, the look of it, and it is beautiful.
Yeah,
I do feel like, though, if he saw the film, he would probably break his hand slapping Barry Levinson. Like, because it is such a weird appropriation of his work.
It's not... I mean, it's almost like, you know, they go, oh, I wonder if that painting could talk. And if it did, it was bad. I don't want to hear that painting talk.
And unfortunately, not only do I get to hear that painting talk, I get to hear it sing like a bad Talking Heads or Men Without Hats song.
By the way, the author of that song, Thomas Dolby.
Oh, there you go.
Who also composed the Howard the Duck song.
Of course.
A classic song that we revisited just a little while ago.
You know who the crazy Jamie Gertz lookalike at the beginning that sings is, right?
Who is it?
That's Wendy from Wendy and Lisa.
Oh, is it?
Prince,
really?
Yeah. From Lisa,
yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Wendy,
so
yes, Lisa.
So it's got all sorts of strange,
are you ready?
Cameo appearances.
Yes, Lisa.
Oh, my God. And by the way, I'm jumping ahead. I'll save this. I'm going to write down what I'm holding on to. So this movie, the way I also think about it is it's a comedy, it's trying to be, but it's like imagined as a drama. Like, that's how I kind of, because it's kind of trying to be a comedy.
There's about 40 minutes in the middle where I counted not one attempt at a joke. Like, they don't even try for a stretch, which is the strangest choice.
And Robin Williams, Robin Williams' character in this movie is a very innocent, young, idealistic man who then all of a sudden is making
not
jokes.
Not so much, though.
Yeah, then it turns out you think he would, he's almost like a really weird child, like Peter Pan type character, but then he, wants to get laid, and he and Robin Wright fuck, and you hear it.
And that,
this movie, by the way, not for kids.
Not for kids.
It looks like it's a movie that's for kids. It's, big and poppy and bright and toys and but it is not even there are multiple sex scenes in this movie.
And the sex scene, by the way.
And I think we listen to him lose his virginity at one point, which is the creepiest thing that ever happened.
100%.
Yeah.
And by the way, Robin Wright really gave it up quick. She was like, I want to be hugged. And she's like, crump, let me take off my shirt. It's like, whoa.
Can I stay here tonight? And she's like, how about looking at my titties?
Now, at that point in the movie, Robin Williams has kind of started to figure out that the bad brother is making war toys. And I thought for sure that sex scene was a diversion because they were being watched by a camera. Jamie Foxx, by the way, in his first ever on-screen role, watching Robin Williams hump Robin Wright Penn. And I thought, oh, that bra over the thing. No. It's just a sex scene.
Yep. Yeah.
Nothing there.
Nothing to it.
But the craziest part of that whole explanation is that evidently Donald O'Connor hired her specifically hoping she would end up fucking his son.
Yes, and Donald O'Connor is the nice brother.
Is the dad.
So it is like the biggest lawsuit in the universe just waiting to happen. Yeah. And then it finally does, and it's creepy and gross.
He not only hires her, he says to her, according to her, you're really gonna, my son's really gonna like you.
Yeah.
And then Joan Cusack, when she sees that Robin Wright, and she goes, he finally found her. I was like, "Whoa!"
It's appropriate that he makes that crazy Michael Jackson joke because this has that same mix of supposed innocence and creepy sex predator vibe. It's perfect.
But there's something funny about him in the sense that Robin Williams, again, I feel like at certain points, you're like, just improvise, have fun with this scene because his character drops. I mean, again, his character is all over the place, but his character makes Robin Williams s jokes. But then for this movie, he's
did
like,
you pull yes, the, did you pull the Gettysburg Address?
Yes. Okay, yes. Good. Should I mean,
we can get to it later, but like that is the quintessence of fuck you, Robin Williams, for doing this.
I have a lot of the songs from the movie as well, if we ever want to dig into that.
Their first lunch scene feels like they must have shot like 6 hours of them flirting, and all of it is him doing bits.
Yes.
It's awful.
And her laughing, which is such a like a sign of a bad comedy movie. I hate that thing where it's like the funny guy with the hot girl, and the hot girl just goes, ha, 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 you're funny. And that's how they connect. Yeah.
Oh, it's worse than that. When he walks in smoking, Joan Cusack actually goes, smoke. That's funny. Yeah. Just to, like, she had to underline it just in case we didn't know it was supposed to be funny.
And I love that there's also like some weird, like, I mean, I'm not one to pick on the fantastical elements of the movie, because obviously, yes, their house is a storybook that opens in a plane, you know, but then they're, you know, so I'm not going to pick on that kind of stuff. But
well, the visuals, a lot of the visuals, I will legitimately say, are amazing.
Yes, they're beautiful.
You know, like, really beautiful visual stuff happens in this movie.
And I remember the trailer kind of selling that element of it, and it looked like, wow, that's kind of remarkable to look at.
And I mean, by the way, we played this on the mini episode, one of the trailers for the movie is just Robin Williams in like a field going, hello, I'm Robin Williams and I think you should see the movie. Like just doing voices, advertising the movie with no clips, just doing crazy Robin Williams voices.
I think that was in theaters right at the same time that Aladdin was out. So he was at an all-time high where it was like, Robin can do no wrong and let him riff. And I think that's what that was trying to tell me.
It's really, really nuts. Because I was like, my basic question was, I get it's fantastical, but what's the baseline? What is the real thing? What's not the real thing? Because it just... I didn't know if there was a real world outside of this world. Like,
didn't seem like. If there is, we barely see it.
Yeah, you don't see anything.
We never leave. There is nothing juxtaposed to their world, right?
Yes.
We never leave their kind of idyllic, weird world.
The only time you leave it is when the kids are in their military training programs and they're clearly bombing and destroying major metropolitan cities that look like ours. So, so there is a real. So basically,
there must be,
Yeah, there's just basically a very large field. It's like a Microsoft or Apple campus, but only with like one very small building on it that has a elephant blowing bubbles out of its nose.
I think one of the things that, and you guys have done a couple of these now, one of the biggest gambles you can do is this kind of world building movie.
Yes.
Because when it goes wrong, it's Nothing But Trouble, or it's Pluto Nash, or it's this, where nothing about the world is interesting, nothing works, and it's such a mess before you even get to what's happening in it.
Oh, completely.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, this movie took 10 months to make.
Oh,
that's a very long time.
Is that right?
Yeah, 10 months.
Oof.
And I feel like that thing that I was talking about with
how
Robin
many
Williams,
mayonnaise sandwiches do you think Joan Cusack had to eat in that time?
Joan Cusack, her character trait is she likes sandwiches.
She likes sandwiches that are just bread, sometimes two slices of bread with mayonnaise, but that's it.
Well, here, let's hear her order another sandwich. We have this clip right here.
Ham and cheese, turkey, chicken salad, shrimp salad.
You know, Joe, I'm very disappointed that you never once had an applesauce sandwich on your menu.
Applesauce? Miss Evo, the sandwich will get all saggy.
Oh, I don't mind.
I'll make you one tomorrow, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
That's a scene from this
scene
movie.
That's a movie!
That's not... It's not like something we recorded to poke fun at how bad this movie is. That is actual dialogue that apparently took 10 years to write.
There was a script supervisor behind the camera going, yep, we got it. There's a cut, different angles
Did
on that scene.
Let's go again.
Yeah, that was,
let's go again.
When they were looking at the 2-hour length, they were like, no, leave that scene in. Does it pay off? No.
Oh, no.
Really.
We never see her eat an applesauce sandwich.
Yeah, that guy lied to her.
In almost every scene, especially in the middle, I have no idea what they connect to or why they're there. There's so many scenes that are like them sitting on the couch doing the Woozy helmet.
Yeah.
Which plays no part at the end of the film.
No.
The Woozy helmet, they put it like three times so you know it exists.
Well, that's the thing is,
you
nothing,
see what it does.
Nothing comes back.
Yeah.
You know, like all of, I mean, like he's got the smoke jacket, which could have been used later in the movie when they go to war. The sound effects jacket, the
fake
the Woozy
puke.
Helmet, the fake puke and diarrhea, although that did make me laugh.
Did you like the novelty test where they're going out in the field and testing?
That was so stupid.
It was like they're in a room. They're like in an R&D room watching like old, like eight, like almost like 8mm footage of like Robin Williams wearing very big ears in a supermarket going, we're testing out the big ears.
Yeah.
And like, what is he just walking around the supermarket? Like, what? Like, I just, I mean, that is just a great dumb thing. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, they test out these things.
It like the idea that it took him. Just the more I think about the idea that it took Barry Levinson 10 years to write this, makes me depressed because this is what he came up with.
Well, to me, it's like, but what is this?
This
movie?
Is what he was honing.
I would say from after the first couple of scenes, which are very long, but you are set up that the military guy wants to make military toys, and Robin Williams does not want to make that. And then there is no other plot complication, really.
Nope. I think that's why they give so much time to the Robin Wright pin thing, because why not? They need to do something to kill time.
That's their B story, and the B story is not really, there's no real obstacle. He meets her, they fall in love pretty instantly. And then they consummate it just a couple scenes later, and then at the end, it's cool. It's like, there's that, it's just kind of like, flowing. You're just kind of like, look at, like,
why does she dress like a crazy person? Why do they? I mean, they all dress like crazy.
I felt like
people,
she dressed like Cher from Clueless. I felt like Robin Wright.
Yeah, but
like,
it's at one point she's wearing like a Scottish out, like a
and
kilt
nobody else
and
is
a
eccentric.
Tam O'Shanter. Yeah, everybody else is like normal and in wearing like all the other toy people are wearing like lab coats and blah blah blah. And she's dressed like a fucking maniac, like in one point she's wearing like a Sergeant Pepper's jacket or something. I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Well, she's in charge of the duplication room. The duplicate. I do have that scene as well. LL Cool J. And now this is what I'll tell you that I remembered from the movie. Thinking LL Cool J was hilarious.
Really?
I was like, I love the fact that he disappears. He's like in the wall. Like, basically, LL Cool J is a very highly trained military guy. He can blend into anything. He's and I just thought LL Cool J was
cool.
The best. He was super cool. And now it did not hold up for me.
No.
I thought he was like full of laughs. No, I mean, this movie, I don't even know. I want to dig into it. And I'm just like, I just keep on thinking back to scenes like the scene with LL Cool J and Michael Gambon around the fire talking about Michael Gambon coming up with the idea of drone ships. Like, he's like, that's basically the premise of the movie. He's like, I'm going to create little drones.
Do you think that drones, our current military drones, were inspired by somebody watching this movie?
Entirely. Well, that's what I said. This movie,
this is it.
This is the foreshadowing. Barry Levinson was right. It was took 12 minutes. He figured it out. Man, oh man.
That's the thing. I wonder if there was ever a draft of this that was more normal, that was more like a Strangelove, that actually understood toys and war toys, and because it seems like that would be maybe interesting. Well, but then you layer all this other stuff on top, and it just gets so busy that you can't even get to that.
Here's my issue with movies about toys in general, and not like Toy Story, but like movies that are Santa movies. They're never making the toys that most kids play with.
Nobody would play with these. They're nightmare machines, most of them.
Yeah, they really are crazy. Oh, speaking of nightmare machines, they do one thing where they're testing out like one doll and they're pulling it by all the arms. Uh-huh. Like, ooh, it's The Last Temptation of Barbie. Robin Williams makes that joke. It's like, all right, so in this world, The Last Temptation of Christ exists. He has seen it and he is familiar with it.
Yep.
So again, where's the fucking baseline? Yeah. Is he innocent?
Where is reality?
Yeah.
You know, because he's got a million, he does a million weird like Robin Williams references.
Yes.
That I'm like, what the fuck is it? Like, has he ever been outside this compound?
And if he's hyper innocent, how does he have all of this in his head?
Yes.
Because it seems like there's no way he's this innocent, naive
character
with all this also bouncing around in
making
there.
Dick jokes the next second. Yeah. I mean, it's like, so that's the other thing, too.
The devil puppet has got to be the creepiest thing.
Oh my God. I want to get laid.
Yeah, that's so wrong on every level. And he was carrying it around just in case. Just to make the reference it looked like.
Oh, yeah.
And
by
he's
stalking her. He's clearly, she's riding her bike home, and he drives right out, and he's like, and, you know, he's like a real pervo.
It's super creepy. And again, we'll say the movie is called Toys. The logo for the film has like rubber duckies on it and stuff like that. It is not a movie for children.
I swear to God, I think every single person in this movie is on the spectrum. You know what I mean? Like, there isn't a person.
I don't disagree with you.
And LL Cool J is this thing about the vegetables on his plate.
How weird was that?
And
I don't want this touching that. That was crazy.
I'm a military man. I like a military plate.
Yes. Yep. By the way, I was saying
what's a military plate? Does that exist? Is that a real thing?
I was actually saying that was my go-to monologue when I was auditioning for theater. Because it was so, like, prepared. It was so, like, I don't like this touching that. I don't like this.
That's
like,
amazing.
It was such a, like I feel like he really got into it. The meat of that scene. Let's hear LL Cool J interrogate Robin Wright Penn in the duplication room.
Are you Miss Quintala? We're doing some routine questions. We'd like you to cooperate, all right?
Okay.
Does any duplicating go on around here when you're not present?
Yeah, maybe.
Do you duplicate alone?
I don't think that's kind of a personal question.
Why are you laughing, Miss Tiley? Are you taking my duplication investigation seriously? Or are you disrespecting my duplication investigation?
No, I'm not disrespecting. I'm just saying that there's no real way I can check, you know, because I leave at a certain time. I'm not...
Duplicating is taking place. And when duplicating takes place, that means that there's more than one. It may be two or three, Miss Tiley. Two, three, or four.
What?
What is going on? These are scenes.
These are lines these actors memorized. They said them in front of Barry Levinson, the writer director, and he was like, goes, yeah, just like I wanted it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. And like that's what? Hearing these scenes without the visuals make it even crazier.
Yeah.
Because it really is. It's like, what is the purpose of that scene? Again, something that doesn't come back. The duplication room, is it just wordplay? Is that what that was? Is that funny?
I think that's what it is. I think that's it's just like, it's meant to be funny wordplay.
Meant to be, maybe?
I don't know. Because otherwise, I don't know what the point of the scene is. His investigation never yields anything.
No.
She never duplicates anything.
No.
Duplication is not even like a thing in
that,
the movie.
And that, by the way, you would think anything would come back, or they would use that duplication room at the end when they have the war of the bad toys and the good toys. There's so many things I also felt like were fixed in ADR too. There's one scene where Michael Gambon is out there talking to LL Cool J, and they're like having this heart to heart, and he's talking about his dream to get children to fly airplanes and massacre people, and that would be the new military, and he's doing this impassioned speech, and then all of a sudden these flares start going off in the sky.
Not only do flares go off, but then we lose them in the sound mix completely. So Gambone's going, in the background, and there's flares from nobody, and there's smoke, and he's on weirdest staging.
He's clearly not launching those flares.
Clearly not.
Where are those flares coming from? And then all of a sudden you hear like this ADR line from Robin Williams, like, always carry a flare. It's like, wait, he was shooting it? Where was he? He wasn't even in the scene.
No. Wait, I thought Michael Gambon ADR'd that line.
No, Robin Williams says a flare line underneath it.
No.
So Robin Williams, I rewound it. So in my mind, it was like, oh, he's also in the field shooting flares.
No, I thought, oh, whoa, that's weird.
Because he would see.
No, I thought it was Michael Gambon who had looped that. Oh, that's
90% because I rewound it because it's like, where are these flares coming from? Because you would show him shooting a gun.
I thought the exact same. Because I thought in my mind, I thought they were fireworks.
Yes, that's what I thought they were.
He's giving this like big impassioned kind of rah, rah, rah military speech, and fireworks start going off. And I was like, oh, okay. So there's fireworks going off. Well, maybe this is just a bit. Maybe this is just a bit of. In this fucking movie, I'll buy a bit of magical realism. Yeah. Whatever. I don't know what's happening. So why wouldn't there be fireworks? And then somebody, I thought Michael Gambon goes, always carry a flare gun or whatever. And I was like, whoa.
I thought that was like they were bridging the date scene with Robin Williams and Robin Wright Penn. They were going to go back over to them because they were out in the field. I don't know. But there's also just moments like. I mean, Robin Williams also is. I mean, there's so many things about this movie.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
The scene early on where they're all working and you see the factory floor and they play that awful Tori Amos song
that they're all
dancing to.
Yes.
So they're obviously listening to it on the factory floor.
And they're singing along.
And they're singing along.
Yes.
So then when Michael Gambon takes over, suddenly there's the hip hop remix of that song.
Yes.
Are they playing that in the factory too? And is that to let them know that he's now a bad guy and that everything has changed and it's awful? And
I'm assuming, yeah.
How weird is that?
Because those people are all singing along in the beginning with that song, which I thought was very strange.
So he actually went in himself, remixed the song that they listened to, and then started playing that on the factory floor?
Well, look, go ahead.
As much as he got them to make a camouflage clown costume for him as well.
Oh, yeah.
Because he also went from being a military man, he outfitted all of his people to be like pretend Nazis. And then he put on a colorful military man outfit.
He's got he's got fatigues that are the camouflage colors are bright poppy toy colors.
Yes.
So I would have liked to have seen those conversations. Then.
Yes.
If we had to watch terrible conversations, why not those at least?
See, I mean, because he, And because also, it also goes against everything that he's setting up, because when you're in his office is taking out all the color and putting up stark black and white, almost propaganda-like images in his office of war, but then he's in this colorful thing and he's running over people. Do you want to hear the Happy Workers song for a second? We'll just hear a second of it. Just I just can't keep complaining this stuff because it's so great. So that goes on for about 4 minutes.
It goes on for like 4 minutes, and this is what everybody... This the presumption, because then you see people singing along with it on the factory floor. Mm-hmm. The presumption is this plays all day?
Yeah.
Constantly?
It is like a weird FAO Schwartz world. And these people... And by the way, these people are coming in. Workers don't live there. They're coming in because that's when they take over the factory. They're being scanned and outfitted and everything like that. So, yeah, they're going insane. This is an insane asylum. Like,
they get paid to go to every day.
Yeah, they're going there.
They're like, I gotta go to fucking work. Oh, I gotta sing that song all day and then have an applesauce sandwich. I'm gonna kill myself.
You said FAO Schwartz. How much do you want to bet when Robin Williams delivers that FAO Schwartzkopf line? What do you bet Barry Levinson was high-fiving himself?
Oh, that was like, that was a home run.
That line is, you're like, the whole thing exists for that line. It's so not worth it.
It's the longest
drive possible to get there.
FAO Schwartzkopf. Well, I do want to bring up, Drew, you might actually run into J.J. Abrams, so I think this is a great chance for you to ask him, did he steal that Mission Impossible 4 gag from this movie?
I was going
to
say, it's the hallway gag is exactly like the one in the last movie.
Yes.
It's just that that's the good version that doesn't somehow involve a terrible music video.
Basically, all right, here's the plan.
Robin Williams needs the MTV logo.
Yeah. The MTV logo. And Robin Williams needs to break into the bad guy's side of the factory because he's taking over the factory slowly but surely. And they come up with an idea that they just go, ooh, MTV.
But that's the answer. How are you going to get in? They're asked, how are you going to get into the restricted area? MTV. What?
Now, by the way, also going against the morals of these characters, because you wouldn't think that these characters are watching MTV.
They haven't even seen a television.
Never. So they create an elaborate thing where they, just like Mission Impossible 4, set out a screen in a hallway where the security hallway is, and anyone can help me out to describe this, and then they are broadcasting a video on that screen, but this is all to distract the security camera, which they have planted a fake MTV logo on. So it would say like security camera.
So like the two guys who are sitting at the security desk are looking at a bank of monitors.
And don't realize one of them suddenly changes completely.
And the monitor that is for the restricted area suddenly is MTV.
Just suddenly has an MTV logo on it. It's changed.
Must be MTV then.
MTV. And they go, I guess it's part of the cable. And the other guy goes, we have cable?
Now, meanwhile, again.
What? These are security cameras. These are not broadcast. These are not TVs.
If you are at your cubicle right now, listening to this, just imagine all of a sudden someone just putting an MTV logo on the bottom of your computer.
Yeah.
You would not be confused that your computer is no longer your computer.
You wouldn't look at it. A screen you've looked at for a long time, you wouldn't look at it and be like, huh.
MTV?
I guess this is MTV now.
So that was their big plan, to create an MTV music video. Now, here's my version of that plan, which is just bypass the cords and broadcast the signal on it that is MTV. No, they're doing a live MTV music
video. I got a better one for you.
Then they get in front of the screen to perform.
Yes.
Instead of using that time to sneak into something.
Exactly. And they're
doing Robin Williams. It's Robin Williams and Joan Cusack, two people who are performing as Yolanda and somebody else. Yolanda
and Steve
is the name of their group.
Barry gave himself, I'm sure.
They're performing their hit song, whatever, and the two security guards are into it, and they don't seem to recognize that the two people who are the owner's son and daughter, who are the two most important people at this company, are Yolanda and Steve. They never say, hey, isn't that what's his name and who's Magoozy?
There's only two people that are, like, it would be like, I was thinking, I wrote this down, it would be like if Obama put on a red hat, you're like, oh, who's that gentleman singing on MTV? This is Obama! He didn't do anything different! Yeah.
We all know who these people are!
They are the figureheads of this company.
Now, this is what I want to try and explain, okay? So So when they pushed the screen in front of they pushed the screen in front so that they can mask so they can go behind a door behind
yes.
them, right?
Yes.
And when they push the screen in front, the first image that's projected onto the screen is a mirror image of the door.
Yes.
Of the hallway and the door. So it looks unchanged.
And that's, by the way, the Mission Impossible version.
Exactly.
You just
now, rather
like
than just leave that, so when the guys look at the camera, what they're looking at is the same security feed and it looks fine.
Yes.
They could have gone and done way more super sleuthing and spying.
Yes.
They take 10 minutes to perform an MTV-style music video.
Yes.
That would have never played on MTV.
That would have never played on MTV. That MTV would never be on the security
cameras. By the way,
cameras. Leave the first thing with the door image.
By
you
the way,
fucking idiot.
They have figured out that much of the technology to already get away with it.
Yeah.
And that,
but they can't help themselves. They're like, I want to. It must have taken them days to make that music video.
Oh, yeah.
Ridiculous.
All those visuals and all the special effects.
By the way, again, I will point out, I will trump your thing and say, or we've already talked about it, which is they perform it live.
Yes.
Yes.
They shouldn't have done that.
Yep.
They should have just, if they wanted to do the projection of the MTV plan, if we agree that the MTV plan was a solid one.
Yep. Just
they
show
should
a video.
Have just projected the video.
Yep.
And by the way, had other videos to follow it. They basically had one video, and Robin Williams and Joan Cusack are both heavily involved in that video. Then he has to wait.
So they don't have time to go and spy.
No. He's got like 12 seconds of workable time to get inside.
While she has a guitar solo.
Let's hear a little bit of this song just so you get a taste of it.
These are the people you haven't even met. Looking forward into the old days.
You don't need to hear more, but
that's
that is
a real song in the movie. It goes on for ages.
Forever. Now,
it's even called back later.
Yes.
When other security guards
Jamie
are
Fox.
Watching it, Jamie Foxx is watching it, and they're like, "Where'd you get that?" And they're like, "Oh, we taped it off of a security feed from an old what?"
So, by the way, these guys are taping security feeds and just passing them.
So now
around.
This is a viral video. this invented viral
Zevo,
videos
only at Zevo factories.
Yeah. By the way, I will buy that when they wrote this originally in 1980. Well, I guess it would be 1980. This would have been a video that played in 1980 MTV. So that, I guess, it makes sense. But 1992, I mean, this is on the Well, actually, grunge. We're in grunge era at this point.
We're past Nirvana.
Yeah.
Nirvana, Smashing Pumpkins, that's all 91.
Can we talk about Randy Quaid, who pops up in the movie for a scene and a half?
Wait, I missed it.
Where? Randy Quaid pops in the room when he's shooting the gun at his foot.
That's right. Wait.
No, you know who that is? That's Blake Clark.
Oh, okay. Good. I'm sorry. All right.
I think some of his earliest work, he was cast as military because he was.
Oh,
Blake Clark used to be military.
Okay, good. Because I was like, I thought, was Randy Quaid just around that day?
Oh,
like, oh,
God.
Get in there.
Get in there.
Get in there. Do the scene.
Quaid, get in there.
And the scene, if you're talking about the scene with the fly, right?
Yes.
Another scene. How does that connect to anything?
Yep.
Isn't this guy a 3-star general?
Yes.
Yes.
This guy actually made it to 3-star general, and yet he's dumb enough to shoot his own foot to try and kill a fly.
Now he's going. And by the way, at that point in the movie, he's going crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have the 2-minute opera scene first.
But there is also where he's singing along to the opera. But there's also no reason for him to really go crazy, because I guess he basically has a plan to meet up with the military, pitch this idea of children killing people.
Children operating remote-controlled, like, toys that are actual killer drone weapons.
Meanwhile, Jamie Foxx and his partner are watching on in a van where they're basically 3D and they're skeletons. That's odd. I won't get into the fact
that
the...
Oh, also there's a sea monster. Also, they've invented a sea monster.
The sea monster.
Yeah.
Don't
know.
Gotta get to that sea monster.
But if you're wondering if there's a sea monster in this movie, there is.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we're not even quite. Yeah, that seemed. All right. So he pitches the idea to the government. The government goes, we got to think about it. To which immediately he starts choking this man.
Yes.
Choking him and trying to kill him. But that psychotic break seems to be not really founded in any way. Like, he's only been successful. It looks like these kids are doing a great job at killing people.
Yeah.
Everything seems according to plan.
But when you talk about them being on the spectrum, that scene where he goes to see Jack Warden, which, by the way,
is the saddest,
creepiest use of Jack Warden.
Oh, yeah.
Between the first one and then the last one where he just pops up and goes, war.
Yeah.
That is so upsetting ever like Jack Warden, ever.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, that whole scene, he's playing it like he's an infant. Like he's
like he's a little boy, like having a temper tantrum.
It is so strange the way they do that. Is that on purpose? Like everybody's supposed to be a kid?
But that's the thing. They aren't, though. Like, sometimes they aren't. Like, it fluctuates from scene to scene.
What about Debbie Mazur?
Debbie Mazur.
Can we talk about Debbie Mazur's character?
Yeah. The
fucks both the dad, fucks both the military dad and his son Jamie Foxx.
Well, but no, his son LL Cool J.
LL Cool J.
And
they were
engaged. It hinges on the idea that he figures out that he fucked his dad, that she fucked his dad, and that's why he finally helps the good guys.
Yeah.
Because they're right.
Oh, because Jane she Fonda. Tells him that his dad is responsible for killing his mom.
By sending
her
undercover.
The mom didn't have appendicitis.
Right, disguised as Jane Fonda.
Oh, yeah.
But that never would have happened if she hadn't made the mistake and said, oh yeah, I fucked your dad too.
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, that's like that coincidental, like everything hinged on this one. He's like just about to have sex with her and she calls him the wrong name, which I feel like is such a movie trope.
Can everybody write in and say on the message boards or whatever, have you called someone or had someone call you the wrong name during sex?
Yes, I buy that is just in movies.
And that moment, that basically hinges, if that moment doesn't happen,
none of the ending does.
None of the ending does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
None of it does.
Oh, no. Because that's the only thing that drives LL Cool J to help the Robin Williams gang.
And help him he does, by basically saying, we'll have a war. Yep. We'll have a war of toys.
Yeah. Because it's basically, at this point, the movie turns into, like, good guys versus bad guys, like a kid's game, except that there's real stakes, because all of the bad guys' toys have real guns in them.
Yes!
Like, there's a little doll that pushes a little baby in a carriage, and then the baby's bottle raises up and is a six-shooter and starts shooting at them.
And then where would that
And then Joan Cusack goes, that's a bad baby. Like, you are almost just killed.
I thought that Joan Cusack was sick the entire movie. We'll get to what
she
is.
I remember you said that in the minisode. Yeah, I think his sister's sick, and I started laughing. I'm like, oh, he hasn't watched it again.
No.
She's going to be, no, we'll tell you what she is in a second.
That fight sequence is 40 minutes. From when they decide to go to war to when they stop the war.
Oh, yeah.
After that insane plane sequence, it's 40 solid minutes.
Yes. And of a two-hour-long movie.
So a two-plus-hour
movie,
I feel like. I fast-forwarded through part of that.
That end sequence,
I couldn't deal with it.
Yeah.
I was,
because I legitimately was like, what the fuck is this?
I was playing a little bit of Simpsons Tapped Out during some of that. I was like, I will say that, again, the conceit of this is an interesting conceit, which is kids flying drone ships and killing because they're really good at video games.
There's
we didn't talk about it when he goes to the video arcade.
The general?
The general goes to a video arcade in one part of the movie, and like he's, what are these video games?
Yeah.
And he starts playing a video game and like, you have to help protect the UN trucks.
Yeah, you have to shoot tanks and don't shoot the UN trucks.
And he just starts shooting the UN trucks because he hates the UN.
Yeah, and he's super awesome at this game.
And he's got the spit on his chin the whole time. Like, Michael Gambon was so disturbing in his career before this. When you look at the Cook, the Thief, His Wife, Her Lover, or the Singing Detective, or any of these, like, he was so disturbing. The idea that they cast him in a comedy was like somebody had an aneurysm while they were in the casting process.
Oh, yeah. This whole movie is weirdly, I mean, and
truly is like, and I don't have any answers. Like, this really is, how did this get made? Like, is a true, like, there's plenty of movies we do that I'm like, I get it.
Right.
I get why this got made. I get what it's a failure or it's a mess or whatever. But I genuinely look at this movie and I'm like, I don't know why.
Who is it for? Words. I know how it got made.
Oh, really? Right. Oh, wow, my gosh.
Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Because they had just done a comedy that was set in an active war with Robin Williams and Barry Levinson. It was a huge critical hit in commercial.
And they said,
now I can finally make my dream movie.
Got it.
But dream movies almost always blow by the time they finally
get made. Isn't that so interesting?
Because people have overthought them and they've had them bouncing around their heads for so long.
Or it's a movie that there is a dream, but everybody thought it was bad. Yeah. So people were like, no, we're not going to do this. Let's do that other movie you want
to
do.
Now, let me talk to you about this. All right, so Good Morning Vietnam was 87, right?
Yep.
Then he did Rain Man. Then he did Avalon. Then he did Bugsy. and then he did Toys.
Yep.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I would. That's interesting.
It was
I would have just building clout.
Like he was on such a roll at that point.
Oh yeah.
And then he finally got to say, "Here's this thing that's been in my drawer. I'm going to do this now, and I want Robin because Robin and I can do this. We can pull this tone off."
And now here's the thing: like he made Wag the Dog in '97, which is a funny commentary on war, and politics,
because it knows something about war. This movie, it's like he doesn't even understand the army. How is LL Cool J, who's evidently active military, hanging around and fucking off with his dad?
Oh, he's so
and
excited.
Nobody cares. Yep, yep. And it's he doesn't. It's like he doesn't get how the army works. So why would you try to make a military satire?
Well, and I feel like people are going, it's like Strangelove. It's like Strangelove, or like that's what like.
No.
But it's like no. This is not. This is not.
Strangelove is about how the reality is so fucking crazy that it's hilarious.
Yeah,
because everything in that movie is real.
Yeah.
Everything.
And this movie is just. It's sort of like the most.
And this movie is like, what if hilarious was reality? It's like the opposite of that.
Well,
you
I was
know?
Saying it's like everyone was like. It's like a psychiatric ward put on a show, and it was like it's just it has those feelings. Like, and then we'll talk about an applesauce sandwich, and then we'll have the duck and they'll fire weapons because again, the toys that he's setting up are that make sense. The drones make sense, but the baby carriage with the machine gun
doesn't.
Where is that going?
Nope.
Yeah.
We're gonna take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk more about this war scene. Guys, MailChimp.com is sponsoring today's show, so please show them some love and head over to their site, check them out, and sign up for their service for free. Now, I know you guys are busy, you got so many things happening in your lives, and you need to let everyone know about them, but you don't know how. If you sign up for MailChimp, more than 4 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to send personalized and custom email newsletters. You can do that too. Don't just send out a generic email blast. Create a sign-up form that match your brand's look and feel. Send your subscribers product updates, event invitations, announcements, or editorial content. Use MailChimp's reports to improve your campaigns and learn about your subscribers. Best of all, MailChimp is free for lists of 2,000 and more subscribers. Check that shit out. Whether you're self-employed, manage projects for clients, or work for a Fortune 500 company, MailChimp has features and integrations that will suit your email marketing needs. So sign up with MailChimp today. Get the word out about how great you or your business is. Just head over to MailChimp.com and learn more. Thank you, MailChimp. Here's the thing. You got this killer startup idea, but you have no place to house your website. Whatever will you do? Well, thank the Almighty right now, because I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go to HostGator.com. HostGator.com offers premium web hosting at a super low price. And they're sponsoring our show today, so head over to their site and check them out. All right? You know, you want to find a .com that works, that not everyone has. PaulShear.com is taken. PaulShear.net is not. There's a lot of .net domain names out there, and HostGator is going to hook you up with it. What does HostGator offer? Well, let me tell you, 24/7, 365 days a year, phone, chat, and email support. So if you need help anytime, night or day, you just give them a call. And don't worry, if your site explodes because you've discovered the next grumpy cat, HostGator will still have you covered with VPS and dedicated servers. I don't know what that means, but it sounds cool. So what are you waiting for? Head over to HostGator.com, buy some hosting, get some .NETs, use a coupon code HOW, that's H-O-W, get an extra 25% off on us. And by doing so, you are supporting the show, and that is awesome, and we appreciate it. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt the conversation, but we have to give a shout out to all of our sponsors who help us keep the lights on, and one of those sponsors is you. That's right, a super fan, Scott Prodan, donated some money to the show. Scott, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Thank you for giving us your money. It helps us so much, and visiting all of our sponsors helped the show. But Scott, a special shout out to you for being awesome. You, my friend, are a true How'd This Get Made super fan. Sorry, so anyway, they decide that the only way to win this war of the toy factory is to have toys versus toys, and Robin Williams must, I guess, empower the toys, which we didn't really realize are alive.
No, he
gives them the Patton Henry V speech, and it's insane.
Let's take a listen to this speech, and I left the whole thing in because it's...
Please, it's so worth it.
Four stores, many Christmases ago, my father brought forth a factory conceived in innocence and joy. squeezable fun for everyone. But today, may be the beginning of the end. Or the end of the beginning. The beginning of the begin. And when you go fourth today, or fifth, depending on your order in line, we are here today to put you in harm's way. Because we determine today in this warehouse the future of toys as we know it.
Try to imagine watching
these
toys.
Toys of fun
and being excited.
Oh, God, we have done it.
We got it.
Try to imagine being like Joan Q's, like a Robin Wright, and having to do take after take of this while he just does this.
Endangered species, you know that.
I mean, and by the way, this is a man speaking to toys that we have never set up in this whole movie. Have any life or personality
to them.
And
I don't think by the end we're supposed to believe that either. I think it literally is just he gives a rallying speech to toys that they wind up and push out.
Yep. And that's all it is.
And then when you watch those toys, they get decimated like Saving Private Ryan. It's like Saving Private Ryan without the emotional stakes. Because you're watching like heads get blown off, like little football men just getting destroyed. It's ultra violent. Yes. It's ultra violent. But yet again, no one is really, like, the toys are getting hurt.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's the lowest stakes war humanly imaginable.
So the war scene is getting out of control at this point. Dolls are dying.
The sea monster's been activated.
Oh, and the sea monster.
Yeah.
Because we want to talk about the sea monster, too. Well, I don't know what you talk about. Elise, what did Alice say? Is that how you say your name? Junkies X-Keller?
Oh.
I guess, basically, the war is almost over. And then Joan Cusack gets hurt, and we find out that Joan Cusack is a robot.
Yes.
Joan Cusack is a robot. Saying that again.
You thought in the movie that she was just kind of a fragile, kind of autistic, maybe, like, on the spectrum, kind of oddball girl.
Nope.
A sheltered kind of homebody. Nope. Total robot.
A robot. She's a robot.
No. I just need people who are listening to the podcast to know.
Just take it in.
The Joan Cusack character, who's been one of the main characters we've seen eat multiple
movie.
Sandwiches. She's eating sandwiches.
With vitamins in them.
Which she did say, though, they go through the system.
Yep.
She said they easily go through my system, which now means something. She's a goddamn robot.
Which, by the way, here's the other thing. Everyone knows.
Yep.
Everyone knew that she was a robot, but us, the audience.
Yes.
Robin Williams is like, oh yeah, she's a robot. My dad created her for me because my mom died early. Wait. Okay, like this.
How is this possible?
And
how is this? No. How is it possible?
So and have they been making age?
Well, that's the question.
She can't grow.
Have
she
they been building a new robot every year?
Well,
that's a little bigger.
Well, no, because LL Cool J goes, it looks like she's always been the same age.
That's creepy.
30?
That's insanely creepy.
So when he was like 10,
she
had a 30-year-old sister.
Yeah.
I mean, what the fuck is going on?
And by the way, their relationship is he takes care of her.
Yeah.
Which you would think would be the opposite.
You know, he doesn't have a mother. Let me build him something that's going to be a burden and responsibility for the rest of his life.
Autistic or on the spectrum, a child that he has to take care of.
Yes.
It's like some...
Because that's so easy and enjoyable.
Yes.
It's some next level craziness when that is revealed. It makes...
When her head came off...
Absolutely. It's infuriating.
When her head came off, not only did I stop it, but then I had to like go like, wait. And I rewound it again, because the crazier thing about her head falling off is no one reacts to it as if like, oh my God.
Yeah.
They go, oh wow.
Okay.
It's over
there. And by the way, you want to take out the stakes of it. It's fine. We can just rebuild her.
Yeah.
Yeah,
don't
totally
stress
fine.
It.
And
if that's the case, why not send her into war immediately?
And,
you know, like why protect her? Why not just be like, robot, go.
She gets taken out. Like a wimp.
Yeah.
She gets taken out by just a stray bullet to the head. She should have done something. She should have, like, touched electrical equipment. She should have done something
robotic. Why
doesn't
she have powers?
Yes. Yeah.
She's a robot. Why doesn't she have strength? Why doesn't she have...
Because she's not getting the applesauce sandwiches.
Yeah.
She needs that for the proper strength. Okay, so her gets her head blown off. And at which point, Michael Gambon runs away to be... kind of targeted by this sea monster that has like a robot
It is the weirdest. They never remotely explain
they
the
never explain
slug
it.
Thing.
The Z slug, we don't know really what it is, but
it's a defense mechanism, but you have to fall into a hole.
You have to fall into a pit
of water that nobody
I think
would
that
fall
were
into.
Keeping it there to monitor it, and then they would eventually unleash it on people in the society. Like almost like this is how I drew it. That it was like a dolphin, like one of those dolphins that finds mines, but it is actually a dolphin that is like a mine. That's how I kind of thought.
You gave it more thought than they did.
You really thought this out.
I think that's way more thought than they gave.
I was just trying to make up for
Drew not
being
here. I
think
it was just a monster. Oh, nice call. Nice, good, good.
But that is really what I did think. That sea monster is loose at a certain point.
On
land, of course.
Yes.
And he's targeting the bad brother, and he's like targeting. So he's part robot, the sea monster, too. The sea monster, I guess, is a toy.
I think it's like a war thing.
And then he quotes the day the Earth stood still at it.
To get it to stop, but then the screen just goes to white.
It still fires, and it looks like it kills him.
Right, and so you think he's dead until the very next scene when you're like, oh, that's kind of crazy. Like, the movie kills two characters, and then they immediately take that back, and they go, well, no, they're both not dead.
Everybody's fine.
Yeah.
JK, guys, JK.
And not only are they fine, but he's now next to his dad, Jack Warden, in the bed. And they're both in the military hospital, which is just in a room in the house.
Yeah.
And with Debbie Mazur. And he's kind of now gone, like, full. Like, he's moved up on the spectrum.
He's super
crazy. So that's the rest of his life now? What a horror movie ending that is.
So he's in that bed, and it's just a conveyor belt of, like, little action figure or Warman figurines coming across.
Ooh,
so upsetting.
So this movie is a fucking
And then they have
bummer.
A happy Christmas song again.
And a happy Christmas
just
song.
To make sure that they leave you on some weird note of...
So has a year passed in this movie?
Yes, I believe a year has passed. Everything is back to normal again. Joan Cusack has still got some learning to do.
It's a bummer.
This movie's a bummer.
Thanks a lot, Drew.
Thing is, I know people who defend this, and
Why do they defend it?
I have a theory that any movie that was on HBO constantly when you were between the age of 8 and 12, you think is great. Because it's Stockholm.
Well, we get that.
Over and over and
we
over.
We encountered that Spice World was one of those movies that really people revolted
on. And then you go
on.
Back and you look at it as an adult and you're like, oh my God, my skull wasn't hard yet. Yeah. What was wrong with me at that age that I love this?
Well, I mean, again, I remember laughing at like LL Cool J. I thought he was really funny. I don't remember any of this other plot. I don't remember the toy fight. I don't remember, but I mean... Man, was there anything that we didn't cover? That I'm just looking through my notes. I wrote at one point, my pen is breaking. I'm taking so many notes because they're just like.
I did too. I took tons of notes on this just because you.
Oh, see, I didn't take barely any notes because I started taking notes and then I was like, "Fuck this movie."
I do want to tell you. Well, let's. I do have some information.
I owe you at some point.
You do. you do. Goddamn
I'm,
right.
I'm
you
glad
do.
That you brought it to our attention. We needed to see it. This is the one movie that on Twitter I've gotten the most negative response to by people like, "Why are you making me watch it with screen grabs of the movie?" It's been so great to watch that come out.
Considering what you've shown, that's a high endorsement. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it was easy to get. Now, obviously, we had an opinion about this movie, but there are other people who have, they think it's a little bit better, and this is now time for a second opinion.
Second opinions.
Okay, here we go. There are so many good ones. I may just read you samplings from them. This one is from Britt Scharenhausen. And he says, "I describe this movie as whimsical. That's a nice way of saying that most people won't like it. You're definitely not going to like it if you have no imagination or you expect your movies to make sense. Like any work that strays far from the mainstream, it's going over the top sometimes. But let that slide and enjoy the bits that do catch your fancy."
Wow.
5 stars. Ooh. 5 stars.
What? Come on, man.
How about this one from Adele Thompson Tinky from New Jersey? She writes, "I like the scenes." She spells scenes S-C-E-A-N-S.
Wow.
"I like the scenes that they do in the movie is good."
Wait, what?
Yep, oh, that's real. I'm reading it real.
Uh-oh.
I like the scenes they do in the movie is good. Like how they made this big room with all these toys. I'm not talking about the storyline. I like this movie for ideas. I saw the buggy and horse that have Ken and Barbie on it in Disney World. It displayed in the Cinderella Castle. And I remember when I just turned 17 then. I have a good memory.
Whoa.
Five out of five.
There's a lot going on in that review.
She's at
Disneyland at 17?
That might have been someone that worked at Zevo. These are now, I'm just going to... okay, this is another one. Possibly the only film next to Peter Sellers' The Mouse That Roared. This has to be the most ingenious film of all time. It's simply a shame that they have yet to release it on DVD, yet they carry all of Adam Sandler's films. That should tell us something about the intelligence and sophistication in America. Oh, well.
Wow.
Oh, well, I guess I just have to buy another copy of this film and press it to DVD myself. Right, so that
I
means
love that it inspires that much passion.
Seriously,
I'm gonna make the DVD.
And you know what? Fuck you, Sandler.
The only
let me make sure to get a slam in on Adam Sandler here.
Also, she's been watching the VHS so much, she's got to buy another copy. The only trouble with this film is that since Barry Levinson took his time writing it, it shows wit and compassion on so many levels that I doubt the average American intellect could understand the film. Most people that I enjoy being around find this to be one of the funniest films in existence. 5 stars.
Oh my god.
And I just wrote, these are two more that
Can
are good.
Imagine, what if you were like on a date with somebody and they were like, you know what my favorite movie is? Toys. I would straight up punch that girl
you
in
go,
the face.
First you go, oh, Toy Story? Yeah, I love Toy Story.
Oh, me too. I love Toy Story 2.
Toys.
What?
Toys.
Bam!
I believe in the state of California totally you could shoot somebody.
Totally justified. For
that. Curling River. It says, the war between the good toys and the war toys is heartbreaking and oddly very realistic. No. No. And no. 5 stars there. And finally, and I know I'm reading
a
lot,
the
but
the airplane that looks like it's badly exactly. blue screened on.
Oh, God. This is one of my favorites here, too. Okay, this is the best. From Gilbert G. Gilbert. I'm not a fan of rap by any means, but I really got a kick out of LL Cool J's performance. And it's fun to watch his character develop into a toy factory loving guy. Robin Williams, brilliant as always, and the rest of the cast is enjoyable as well. I think the most important scene in this movie is definitely the fake vomit testing room that turns into a potentially deadly crossword puzzle.
Wow, that's a totally different read than I had.
That is the most important scene?
Yeah.
That scene feels like they went in for reshoots. Like, shit, we didn't have anything.
We need something that's
funny.
We need
a scene where you guys just improvise about fake vomit for 5 minutes.
Like, that scene, actually, I did enjoy.
Forever. I mean, we have that on tape, too. But they basically just...
I like when the guy goes, oh, that's diarrhea. That shouldn't be in here.
They sit around a fake vomit. Oh, that's our Wolfgang Chuck. That's our Maui Heave.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, we need to add fake carrots in there. And then the room is basically coming in on them.
Yeah.
Because as they expand, I guess the walls are flexible in this world.
Oh, yeah. Because the cafeteria walls.
More room, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guys, Drew, I appreciate you bringing this to our attention.
I don't, Drew.
Because
you and I are enemies.
Yes,
I
do that's believe, fine.
I do believe, though, that this is, if we had to vote on it, this is the number one movie of how did this get made, because it really, how would you sell it? How would you pitch it? And I think you're right. The only way you could have done it is based on Barry Levinson was just hitting them out of the park.
Yeah.
Boom. Consistent, consistent, consistent. And then it was like, and this is my dream. Do you know, you probably have a memory of this. What are some other like of these dream projects that have gone horribly wrong? Like, are there any that come to mind?
Oh man. It's not a fan, but yeah, it's one of those things that it's almost always a red flag when you hear a filmmaker say, "I've for 20 years this has been the thing that I've wanted to make," and they make it finally.
Yeah,
it just seems tough.
I want to see, because like James Cameron also talked about Avatar and writing it, and they weren't ready for it. But like, I want to see Barry Levinson throughout those 12 years, like taking that script out of the shelf, you know, off the drawer, and going, "Okay, skip back into it. I think we need a fake vomit scene.
Yeah. Ooh, I did some good work on toys today.
It was him and his wife at the time, Valerie Curtin, who was his co-writer for like And Justice for All and Old Friends. And there was a whole series of things. And then he went off and started making movies and just kind of held on to it as his thing. I wonder if she saw the final film and was recognized anything that they had.
That'd been. Be interesting, yeah.
I would love to hear Barry Levinson talk about this movie because I don't think he has. I went.
Was it received, Will?
No, it wasn't.
Right?
Okay. It vanished quickly.
Yeah, it was. It was.
How much did it cost?
It actually cost quite a lot. I'll tell you right here. Here we go. The budget was $43 million, which in 1992 was a lot of money.
Yeah, that's still a big movie.
And especially a movie that's pretty much all on sets. It's not, you know, and it only made $23 million.
Ooh, that's worldwide.
That's worldwide.
Really?
Worldwide.
Wow.
And this was between Aladdin and Miss Doubtfire. So yeah. He was as hot got at that moment.
Holy cow.
Well,
that's
and again,
amazing.
When you see that, and the way, I mean, the tagline for the movie is laughter is a state of mind. It's everything about it is making you go, this is fun.
Yeah.
As I'm looking at this poster right now online, I'm going, I think my dad had this on Laserdisc because I think he was like, you like Robin Williams? We'll watch this.
Oh, funny.
And I remember just like, maybe it's adult. I don't get it.
I think I saw this in the theaters. I was 20 at the time. So.
Yeah. Wow. I want to get, if anyone knows Barry Levinson, and I would love to hear him speak about this movie, because I feel like now with perspective, I wonder if he defends it. He did win, was nominated for a Best Razzie Award.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie won, was up for an Oscar for Best Art Direction, which it should have
totally,
been.
Totally,
great.
Beautiful. Visually beautiful.
If a painting came to life, you wouldn't want to see it. That's how I describe toys. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, you can check us out in all different ways. Drew, what's the best way people can see you and check out your stuff?
They can follow me at Drew at HitFix on Twitter, or HitFix.com is the website where I review films and write about everything that's in production.
And so. I got to say, that is there are many sites out there, and that site is a great site. I love the iPad app for it. I'm a fan of that site, and you guys do great stuff there. If you have not checked out that site, check out that site. You can follow Jason. You can follow me on Twitter at Paul Scheer. Jason?
Yeah, no, you can't follow me on Twitter.
Of course not.
You guys know better.
And Jason and I are in the league. This week on the league, Dirty Randy and Rafi have their own adventure.
The whole episode.
This is going to be crazy. None of the characters from the league are in it. It is a solo adventure of those two characters. Check that out Wednesday, 10:30. And as always, very big week for NTSF. Our London episode. We went to London. We shot in London with amazing people. Anthony Stewart Head, Julian Barrett.
Giles.
Yeah. Colin Salmon. Saskia Reeves from Luther. Amazing, amazing people. We're doing a half hour long episode all in London. Check that out. Adult Swim Thursday night. Please watch that. It starts at midnight this week. And also, this show would not be complete without thanking everybody here at Earwolf. Give it up for our engineer, Frank Capello, who cuts this show, does an amazing job every single week. And also, all of the interns who have been working so tirelessly to help this out. They are Nathan Kiley, Avril Haley, Katie Dyer. Am I pronouncing that right, Katie? Leanna Waldron and Sonia Weiser. These people have worked their asses off to make sure that I have the most up-to-date info about these terrible, terrible movies. Thank you guys so much for all of your help, all of your creativity, and we couldn't do the show without you. All right, thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio. Boom.com. The wolf dead.
This February, true legends from the worlds of comedy and music will unite to form the Supergroup. I'm Tawny Newsome. On every episode, me and my co-host, Alex Kleiner, will invite our talented friends to write and record an original song with us over the course of a week.
You'll hear every step of the process, from writing and rewriting to recording and mixing. Songs with Open Mike Eagle, Paul F. Tompkins, Ted Leo, Woo! Sashir Zameda, Janet Woo! Barney, and more.
The Supergroup. Join the band February 6th on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.